Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, and home to interviews from entrepreneurs all over the world, including, I think today, where we've got an entrepreneur from the Netherlands. In this interview, we're going to find out how an entrepreneur who says that he didn't have much formal business education, how he ended up building a successful watch company. Jordy Koblenz is the founder of TW Steel, a Dutch watchmaker known for its big in oversized watches. I invited him here to tell us how he built up the company. And this interview, like so many others here on Mixergy, is sponsored by this gentleman right here, Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. I'm holding up the mug because this is my revolution in advertising, mug advertising. You've seen audio ads, you've seen billboard ads. Now Andrew Warner is revolutionizing advertising once again with mug advertising. But I'll tell you more about Scott later on. For now, Jordy, I want to welcome you. Thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you for having me.
Did I get it right? Are you in the Netherlands in your office?
Yeah, I'll put this one on silence so
you
don't get
it.
Disturbed. So yeah, thanks for having me.
I said founder, but technically, truthfully, you are the co-founder with your dad.
Exactly, yeah.
Before you started working with your dad, what's your earliest memory of him?
Well, my earliest memory, you know, of course it goes back to my childhood when, I mean, you know, my father, I mean, you know, when I grew up, of course, my father, you know, he was always very passionate about a lot of things, and he was always an extremely hard worker, somebody that, you know, was not scared of taking, you know, a little bit of risk. He was a bit doing a lot of, you know, he was, you know, my dad operated a lot by himself. That's when he operated best. I think that's also where he and I, you know, difference the most. Where, you know, I because of course now with TW Steel, we have so many employees and, you know, it's not really my dad's world, you know, that's not something that he would ambition. So, but I always remember that my dad was just an extremely hard worker. The one thing that he always taught me is with money, you make money. It's something that he always said to me, listen, you know, save, you know, make sure that you always have money, because when an opportunity arises and there's an opportunity for you to invest in something, you know, you want to have that cash, and, you know, you should only rely on yourself, you know, to have it. You don't want to, you know, when being an entrepreneur is sometimes doing things that other people don't understand. And if somebody don't understand it, they're not going to borrow you money or, you know, with banks, you know. But if you have it yourself, you can just, you know, do whatever you want. And it gives you a certain freedom. And he was always, you know, he was never a big spender. You know, my dad, you know, yes, of course, you know, everybody likes nice things. But, you know, back in the days, of course, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. But, you know, even when he made some money, he was always very, you know, careful with spending it and spending it wisely.
And, you said that he liked to operate on his own and he was a hard worker. Before you were a teenager, what was the work that he did largely by himself?
So my dad, he used to be the distributor of some watch brands in the Benelux. He stopped with that and then he started to go into advertising. So he worked for several, you know, magazines, selling advertisers, newspapers. And at that time, of course, I mean, you know, now you have internet and everything. But at that time, you know, you still had everything was done on print. So he started to develop his creative side into, you know, not only selling the ads, but also making sure that, you know, when you sell something, also putting the ads together. And I think that led to him becoming, you know, taking his next step in his career, starting his own advertising agency, where again, he started to work for watch brands, you know, work for the Swatch Group, you know, did a lot of advertising campaigns, you know, for a lot of different companies. So then he was on the other side of the table when he was dealing with the magazines and the newspapers.
I used to go and work at my dad's office back when he manufactured women's clothing in Manhattan. Go figure. There was a time when you could do that. And I remember just watching him and wanting to work there. Did you do that before you started officially working with him?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
What kind of jobs did he give you growing up?
Well, I mean, you know, my dad was, you know, he was always, you know, pretty tough on me, you know. I mean, you know, it was not, you don't get anything for free in life. And, you know, by just, you know, helping him around, cleaning things up.
What do you mean by tough on you?
No, I mean, he was always like, you know, nothing comes for free in life. So, you know, it's, if you work for something, you know, then you need to earn something. If you want something, you know, you're not just getting it.
So he didn't give you an allowance every week. He said, you earn your own money by working for me, and then you can use it to buy candy.
Yeah.
Did you ever resent it? Did you ever feel like, come on, Dad, your job is to take care of me. You buy me the candy. I need you to nurture me. I don't want to have to work for it yet.
No, I think, I mean, of course, I mean, you know, when you're a kid, you know, I mean, everybody, you know, wants to get things easy, of course. But I don't know, it was because I was brought up that way. It was always like, you know, there's certain tasks, errands that you have to do, you know, whether it's to mow the lawn or, you know, do something, you know, you just have to, you know, be part of the household. I mean, you know, my dad, you know, why shouldn't I do nothing and get everything? I mean, you know, everybody, you know, you're a family and you're, you know, you need to work together. So everybody has their task. And it wasn't like that I had to work the whole weekend or something to get, you know, a couple bucks. But, you know, I mean, it just had my, you know, had my things to do, you know, as part of the family business. And but when, you know, office wise and his work wise speaking, you know, I always went there. I mean, of course, when I had to do presentations at school because my dad had an advertising company, you know, of course, I always went to the, you know, to his company. And, you know, I think I was, you know,
You had a professional ad agency help you design your presentations for school.
I mean, you know, there were some presentations that were at a level that, you know, not an 8 or 10 year old could make them.
I see.
But, you know, I was, you know, the thing was, I was, you know, when I came to the office, I was always nice to the people and they always liked me. So I always asked them when my dad wasn't there, of course, like, hey, can you help me out? And they always wanted to help me out. So, yeah, I mean, definitely had some killer presentations at the for school. But,
right on.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a good experience. And you know, I just loved helping my dad, you know, clean up or, you know, just whatever he wanted me to do because, you know, I just had an interest for, you know, for what he was doing.
Then you were 15 years old, and that's when you first got into the watch business. What did you do at 15?
Well, my dad at that time, he stopped at the advertising agency. He wanted to do something completely different. And he then started to do watches again. He saw an opportunity. He started a new watch brand. And I just had an immediate interest from a sales point of view. I think also, you know, at that time, I was still in school. And I started to, you know, take some watches to school and show them to my friends. And all of a sudden, you know, I ended up, you know, at their parents' home and they liked the watches. They started buying something.
You mean your parents' your friend's parents were your first customers of the watches?
Yes, exactly.
I see. And unlike selling candy or newspapers to neighbors, when you sell watches, there's a big markup. So you are making a good amount of money then on each sale, right?
I was making a good amount of money. And, you know, I remember that at one stage, my parents were asked to come to school. And, you know, the teacher said, or the, you know, the supervisor, he said, listen, you know, I've got some, you know, bad news. You know, your son is dealing in stolen goods. So my parents were like, what? I mean, he's selling these expensive watches here, and you know, I mean, it's impossible that you know that he gets them in an honest way. And you know, my father of course explained, well, you know, that's, you know, it's my company, and he sells them because they were quite expensive pieces. But you know, I mean, you know, my friends, their dads and their uncles, I mean, they loved the product, and I was able to, you know, offer them, you know, a good deal, and so that of course got some of the kids interested as well. And what I did immediately was like, okay, listen, you know, you bring me, you know, a sale and I'll give you some commission. So at that time, I mean, you know, when you're like 15, 16 years old, if you, you know, 10, 20, 30 bucks, I mean, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I was making, you know, good profit on the watches.
The one thing about that.
Yeah. The one thing that my dad did from the very start was you know, I had to buy the watches at the same price that other salespeople were buying it. So I didn't get any benefit or any, you know, a lower price. You know, I mean, I was treated exactly the same. So, you know, that just made me, and he put targets in place, like with the other salespeople. Okay, listen, you sell so many pieces, they'll give you a bonus. And it incentivized me, of course, to, you know, work even harder.
Did you like that, or did you feel, again, I'm not one of your employees, Dad, you should just be hanging out with me?
No, because, you know, I mean, I was like, yeah, business is business, you know what I mean?
I think that's the way I would be too, actually. That's the kind of relationship I like.
I mean, you know, my dad was extremely fair.
And plus, he's treating you like an adult. That's the part that I would like.
Exactly, and it made me feel responsible, and it made me also feel like, listen, I really did this by myself, you know? I really... You know, this is something that I did, and it just made me feel good about myself.
And then you took what you learned there, and you started JC Records when you were 19. What was JC Records?
I mean, there was a, you know, in that time in between, you know, I finished high school, didn't went to university. I was like, you know, I mean, I have to be honest, I was making, you know, some good money, and I was like, listen, I just want to, you know, I want to do business, and, you know, I was, you know, fairly good at it. So I was like, you know, this is something that I just want to do. But I was doing watches for, you know, a couple of years already. And my dad started a new watch brand. And it was, you know, more through the traditional jeweler trade. So, you know, I was doing the sales rep function. And, you know, I mean, I was like 18 years old. And, you know, it's not the most exciting job in the world. So I was like, I just want to do something completely different. And I was a hobby DJ for you know, several years, and I was like, you know, I just want to take that to a more professional level. So I started my own record company when I was 19. Yeah, called JC Records, and which for me was pretty much like a dream come
true. Can you make money in that business, or is that just a fun project?
No. I mean, definitely you can make a lot of money.
How did you make money in the record business?
Because I started my own record store, so a specialized store just for DJs.
Okay.
And I started selling vinyl and equipment, and I did, you know, I did for whole clubs, full equipment, the whole interior, everything. So yeah, I mean, it was a very, very good business.
And this is in the early 2000s.
I started that so it was 10, 11 years ago. Yeah, 2002, 2003. Yeah.
And then you saw an opportunity that got you to start this watch company. What was that opportunity that made you say, this is our spot?
Well, I mean, I was performing all over the country. I was, you know, playing a lot of, you know, a lot of clubs, and I saw a lot of people. And the one thing is that when you monitor people when they're, you know, going out, drinks, bar, clubs, it's, they're put on their best clothes. Yeah, I mean, they put on their best their most expensive outfit. So they're trying to look their absolute best. So the products that they're wearing, that's what they love the most. So, and I saw that a lot of girls were wearing big watches. I mean, there weren't any big watches available at that price point, but I saw that they're trying to wear the bigger watches available. Guys as well. But, you know, there was just not something out there. And, you know, you could see that, you know, you saw some jewelry that was getting bigger, but there wasn't a watch brand out there that was really, you know, offering that that style, that look and feel at that price point. So I just saw that there was a gap in the market, and, you know, spoke to my dad about it, and, you know, asked him to design a couple pieces, and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, TW Steel was born, and as a very, very simple project. The whole concept was created in 30 minutes. You know, we had four steel cases. We called it the watch in steel because it was TW steel, and it was four steel cases. So
what is it? TW stands for the watch.
The watch.
The watch steel.
The watch, yeah, the watch in steel.
The watch
in
steel.
Because it was four steel cases. So.
And the first watches you made, the bands were leather, but the watch face was steel, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the cases were steel.
How did you know to do that? How did you know what the design – I understand how you figure out the size, but when it comes to the design, did you go back to your dad's experience and
his salespeople
and say, this is what sells?
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, sitting with my dad and coming up with the design. I mean, Yeah, where does the design come from? I mean, it's just it just happened. You know, we felt that okay, oversized this, boom, yeah. I mean, hook crown, yeah, looks, yeah. It was, you know, the design was just created, and you know, we liked it, and then we thought, yeah, okay, this is something that we can work with.
I'm looking here in my research at the first watches. There's something like, it's either 20 or 22 watches. I can't figure it out because there's TW1, TW2, etc. But TW1 is also TW21. So 20, 22
watches. Yeah, that's the different size.
Different sizes for the same watch. Yeah. Why come out with 22 options instead of just one at first? I don't understand the watch business. That's why I'm asking.
No, we started with four, TW1, 2, 3, and 4. And after that, we made different executions, of course, of the same design.
I see. So the same watch face that started out with a black band later on also had a variation with a brown band.
With a brown band, and then in yellow gold, and then with the tachymeter on the bezel, and with stones, and with, you know, all different, with white strap. Yeah, all different kinds of executions. Yeah.
Okay, so the design, the actual creation of the watches was in your dad's hands. You were,
yes,
the guy in charge of sales and marketing, right?
Yes.
You don't have a huge amount of money. You didn't raise funds for this, did you? Did you ever raise money for it?
No.
And you told us earlier that's part of your dad's philosophy. You shouldn't have to depend on other people. You should have
exactly
your own budget.
Yeah, I mean, I made not a huge amount, but, you know, I made some good money before that. And, you know, I saved up and invested it into TDBC. And it was just, I invested it into the stock because I ordered the stock. And I hardly did any marketing. I just did, a small little brochure. I didn't even do photography. I just took the first pictures, the designs, the drawings from the computer. I put them in a brochure. So I had zero cost.
Who did you take it to? So you had the watches, you had brochures that you made yourself. Who did you take those brochures and watches to make? Where did you get your first sale? Let's start with that.
Well, I mean, of course, I had a pretty big network from before. So
from being a DJ?
No, from being in the watch business from I was 15. I mean, by the time I did that for several years, I had, you know, at one stage, I had like 10 or 11 people working for me that were selling the watches for me. So I had quite an extensive network that I could reach out to. And of course, I had DJs in my store, known DJs from Holland. So I, you know, gave them some product for them to show it off, and started to, you know, ring some of my old friends that I used to work with in the past. And, you know, there was one, he was a distributor in Holland that I talked to, and you know, asked him to, if he could represent the brand. And he, you know, then started to target some of the jeweler stores. And all of a sudden, it started to get some traction.
You said that you gave out watches to DJs so that they, if they wore it, then other people might want the same watches they have. But
yeah.
I'm picturing a DJ. People might notice her watch or his watch in this case. But to then to make the connection to who made it and then to make the connection further to where I can go buy it seems like a couple of big leaps. Did it work out that if that the DJ's wearing it, did they actually translate to more sales?
Well, I think it's always difficult to relate, you know, to relate it directly to sales. But several of the DJs, I mean, you know, they're interested in making money as well. And I had several DJs that I gave some watches to, all of a sudden they started ordering watches as well. It's like, hey, listen, I got a buddy, he wants to order some product.
And, they became salespeople for you.
Exactly.
And they were earning a commission too.
And they were earning a commission as well. So, and it's, you know, when you're talking of watches, you know, for, you know, 200, 300, 400, 500 euros. Eh? So let's say $400, $500, $600. I mean, you know, 10%, 20%, 30%. I mean, it's good margin. That they were making, and it was a nice added business that they didn't have to do anything for, because they were coming to my store anyway to listen to all the records and pick out the new music. So for them to just pick up a couple watches and sell them, it was an easy job.
What I just don't tend to think of DJs as being willing to sell, because I think that
no, but it's it was more that the request came. I mean, it wasn't like I gave them watches and like go out and sell, but you know, they would be standing in a club and, you know, the club owner would come to them. Oh, that's a nice watch. Yeah, it's this new brand. And, you know, the owner is from this record store where I always go. Oh, I mean, can you hook me up? Yeah, of course. Yeah, no problem. So the next minute it's like, oh, that guy wants a watch. Yeah, okay, perfect. I said, here, you know, $50 for you or some free records. Like, okay. Oh, yeah. They never thought about that. And all of a sudden they're like showing it to people. Hey, you know, look at my new watch. And started, you know, it's, you know, sometimes people don't realize that, you know, they can make money off of something. But you know, when you actually put them in that position and say, hey, here's $50, here's $100. And they're like, oh, wow. Oh, thanks. Yeah. Oh, that's great. I mean, you motivate them.
Let me see what's next then. So you go to them. You also went to the Dutch distributor that you told us about. You also went to stores. Did you go store to store and make sales in the beginning?
No, I mean, I had the distributor in Holland. He did that. Yeah. So he started to go to the jewelry stores and started selling the watches. Yeah.
I see. And the distributor is someone who you met from before when your dad was, when he did promotion for watches.
No. It was actually somebody that did some repairs for some of the other brands that my dad was doing. So somebody that we knew for quite a while, and he was also involved in the process of the startup of TDB Steel. When you know we went to him as well and said, "Listen, what do you think? Do you think you can sell this?" So you know, and he immediately picked it up and started running with it.
This was, what year was it that you guys launched?
2005.
Yes. How do you incorporate when you're in the Netherlands? What's your corporate structure?
What, right now or back then?
Back then.
There wasn't pretty much.
It was a partnership, a handshake agreement between you and your dad. You didn't go out and get a corporation or anything.
No, it was, I already had a limited company for my record company. So I just started, selling it through that. Yeah. And, that was the first, because it was nothing. I mean, it was a couple watches and it was a side project. Yeah, fun. You know, we'll sell some watches and maybe we sell them maybe, you know, within a week or within a month or within 6 months. We don't know. But we saw an opportunity and it was like, you know, let's just go for it.
All right, let me use that as a jumping off point to quickly thank Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. And someone in the audience said, hey, Andrew, do you have a case study, an example of what Scott has done? And I do. Mighty Text. Mighty Text first got together with Walker Corporate Law for their $2,900 all-you-can-eat startup package. Then they use them for a convertible note, seed financing, then their stock option plan. That's the idea behind Walker Corporate Law. They help you get started, and then they're there for you later on for the more critical parts of growing your business. So you can go to Walker Corporate Law, which is what I recommend, walkercorporatelaw.com, or apparently Scott is willing to give out his phone number and email address here, and so I'll do it. Phone number is 415-979-9998. Email is scott@walkercorporatelaw.com. Frankly, I don't expect anyone to write down the phone number while I'm talking here. I'm just reading it out because I can't believe that he wants people to call him. I never want anyone to ring my phone. He does, and I'm saying it out there just because I'm as surprised as maybe the person listening. More importantly, if you do want to contact him, the email address I use for him is the same one he wants me to hand out, which is just scott@walkercorporatelaw.com. All right. You then decided to sell online. At what point did you go online?
Oh, no, way later.
Way later. So here's what I found out, actually, then. Did other people start selling your watches online?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, online is something that, we can't go around.
So you were selling to others. They then took it and made it available online.
Yes. And it was mostly jewelry stores that also have an online platform.
So what I see or saw back in the early days of your site, you used to say that you don't take responsibility for watches that people bought online. The warranty only covers watches that are bought in stores, but not why, what was going on there that made you decide?
No. What we said that from unauthorized retailers.
I see.
So anybody that is authorized to sell it, I mean, that's no problem. But, you know, the thing is that we want to control our brand, and we want to make sure that people that buy a TW Steel will get the right experience with TW Steel. And you know, we also want to protect our dealers, because these are people that spend a lot of money on rent, staff. They built their brand for the store over years and years of hard work. And we don't want somebody to, in a back room have a small computer with zero overhead cost, taking advantage of the hard work that has been done by these jewelry stores that we built such good relationships with. So we want to make sure that we protect them. And we don't want, somebody taking advantage of the hard work that has been done.
You know what? I'm reading The Everything Store, the biography of Jeff Bezos, a founder of Amazon. And they had a similar issue where big, well-known, respected brands didn't want to sell their apparel and other related products on Amazon because they didn't want Amazon dragging down the price of their products and making them into commodity products. It sounds like that's what you're saying here. If you allow anyone online to sell your product, it's a race to the bottom to see who can sell it for cheaper.
Exactly.
I see. And that's why you hold back from the beginning.
Yes.
I did see, though, that your watches are available on Amazon right now. Is that through you or someone else?
I mean, there are some official resellers that sell them on Amazon. But we also, like every brand, you have, people that... there's still internet fraud if somebody goes to a jeweler and says, hey, listen, here's cash money, I want to buy 10 pieces at a high discount, and they put a very small margin on them and put them online with discounted. It's very difficult to control that completely. But, we have a department doing nothing else but scanning everything, buying product online, seeing where it comes from, and we're closing stores down and we're closing distributors down.
You are looking to see who is selling your stuff, who's selling fraud and knockoffs of your stuff. You have people who buy it and then you take them down. How do you take them down if they're in the U.S. or if they're in China and they're not in the Netherlands?
We have partners in every country. So if something comes from country X, we go to the distributor and say, listen, we found out this product has been bought. We scan it because each watch has an identical code. It went to that jewelry store. It ended up on internet.
And so it's now on them to take it down. What do they do to take it down?
Yeah, they will go to the jeweler and say, listen, this is what we discovered. They probably start off the warning first. It depends a little bit how serious the situation is. If we all of a sudden see dozens of pieces or hundreds of pieces, then of course we know that this guy's not going to stop with it, so then we terminate the agreement with them.
Speaking of partners, you told April in the pre-interview that one of your problems is finding the right partners. A lot of people talk a big game but don't deliver. Give me an example. I don't understand how that plays out. Do you have an example?
Sometimes you go to a company and, they say that, they're very experienced in the market and they've got great salespeople and they've got this great, and, they've got a lot of marketing experience and, they present you with the plans and it looks good and it's a big corporation. It turns out that, the salespeople are, not focused on your brand, and they're being instructed to focus on other brands that they maybe have a better deal with or something like that, and it just that's hurtful for the business, of course. Sometimes companies are too big, sometimes they're too small. Sometimes we have small companies that do extremely well and big companies that perform very bad, and vice versa. So the management of the brand in that particular market is so crucial for the development of the brand. I mean, it's really
Management of the brand. How much of that is in the distributor's hands, and how much in your hands?
I mean, it's how the brand performs is 100% up to the distributor, because, you know, the product works. So that's no question. I mean, how successful it is, it's for 100% up to the distributor. And of course, I have to say it also is up to us to manage the distributor the right way. But we provide them with all the tools they need to make it happen. And a good example is in Australia, where we had a distributor and they were, you know, the turnover was very, very low. And we changed it into our own subsidiary office. And, you know, we're doing, you know, 50 times the turnover.
Why? What's the biggest thing that you're doing differently to increase sales by 50 times?
Focus, right stores, dedicated sales team, doing nothing else but TDB Steel, pushing every day, opening kiosks, shop and shops. We just opened a flagship store in Sydney. I mean, those kind of things. I mean, that's what's driving the business.
And then what gets people to come to those stores? Is it a lot of advertising? Is it?
Advertising is crucial. I mean, marketing is, if your product is right, advertising is absolutely crucial.
What about what you called, I don't know if you still call it that, but one of your early moves was to get ambassadors. You had Tommy Robredo?
Yes.
The tennis player.
Yes.
How important is that?
I mean, it gives the brand identity. It gives the brand voice. You know, by having somebody at that level speaking very positive about the brand, it touches the people. You know, it has more emotion to it. You know, works with events. You know, the ambassador program works extremely well for us.
What do you pay someone like Tommy Robredo to wear the watch, to talk about it at events?
Well, I mean, of course, you know, unfortunately in contracts we have always a confidentiality clause, so I can't disclose exactly what we pay. But it depends on the profile of the ambassador. You know, Tommy Robredo was, he was good at what he does, but he wasn't, the best performing in his segment. So, but it, you know, he still was, cost us a decent amount of money. It also depends on how much of that time you're using. You know, if you're using, you know, if you want to have 10 appearances a year, I mean, yes, of course, that costs more money. So,
let's see what's next. Oh, actually, here's the next thing I want to talk to you about. Your dad worked Best Alone, and at this point, you guys have been working together maybe 2-3 years. What's it like when you're so social, you're hanging out with DJs, you're good in front of a crowd, and your dad prefers to work by himself?
I mean, my dad always worked from home. So, you know, he did what he had to do, and he was just, it worked perfectly. I mean, I was running the business, and he did the designs by himself, and that was a perfect scenario. I mean,
and who leads the design? Is it you telling him, hey, look, Dad, I value your design eye, but frankly, I'm out in the marketplace. I'm talking to the distributors, and what they're asking for is X, and what you're creating is Y.
No, I mean, we have so much respect for one another that we just hear each other's opinion out, and I think. There's never been a moment if he tells me no, listen, I'm 100% convinced that this is what we need to do. I'm like, okay, well, if you're that convinced, I mean, and you know, and vice versa. If I tell him no, I mean, I really think we shouldn't do this, then you know, he's like, okay. I mean, it always goes. We never have any arguments about that. It's always goes, yeah. I mean, it goes very smoothly, and when I speak, of course, when we create a new collection and I visit some key retailers and get the feedback, that's feedback directly from the market where you need to listen to. And it's not then me saying it, but it's, you know, the people in the business, in the trade, on the floor saying it as well. So,
from a very digital world, Jordy, where if you have an idea, you can test it by creating a landing page, by even A/B testing the landing page. So you have a couple of variations of it and you see what people are most drawn to. And then after that, you can create the product that's that the landing page promised. And then after that, you keep testing and testing and testing. Frankly, I'm going to be looking at the stats of this interview to see how well does this do versus my other interviews. Should we do more watch interviews based on that? So everything is testing. You're in a hard product business where you can't create 50 different variations of a watch, test it to figure out which is the one that you should be selling. How do you know then what to make and what to invest your time in? You're smiling. This is an issue.
Yeah, no. It's just interesting because it pretty much comes down to, you know, the knowledge that you have of the watch industry, certain trends that you see happening color-wise. And, you know, I mean, we do test. I mean, if you introduce a new collection, you know, we'd use different executions and you do test then
how
it works best. No, I mean, just, you know, by putting it in the stores.
So you make small batches and then you put them into stores around the world and you see how people react?
Yeah, I mean, you just do different executions and you just, I mean, you know, it's business instinct and experience that you know that, okay, well, you know, this type of product, it will just do well. And of course, I mean, sometimes, you know, you're wrong. I mean, and most of the time it's, you know, we're very right.
You know what? I think I learned best through examples. Do you have a specific example of a watch that you made that was the wrong one? If you can talk about that and why it was wrong, I think I'll have an understanding of your process.
Now, for example, I mean, when we did the Formula One deal, we did it with a good example is with the Renault F1. And we, you know, I mean, Renault F1, strong name, but we made some designs and we put Renault F1 on the dial. And when we put it out in the market, we the immediate feedback was, okay, listen, people love the design, but they don't like the fact that it has a Renault F1 on it, because they're not buying the watch because it's you know, because it has Renault on it. They buy the watch because it's steel. And it was like, okay, so I mean, all of a sudden you're like, okay, so we should never do that again. We should never put, you know, it just should be TDB steel and that's it. So, you know, we changed it very quickly and solved the issue by not having it on the dial. But it's the feedback from the market.
I see that watch right now. TW Steel is big under the 12. Underneath that in small, it says Renault F1 in the yellow box. It's so subtle. How did you know that was the problem that people had with the watch?
Because we got that's the feedback that we had.
How do you get? What's your feedback loop? Is it the store that's giving you feedback, or do you have
a way? Yeah, salespeople on the ground that tell the store managers, and the store managers tell the distributor, and the distributor tells us, of course.
I see it, by the way, on Amazon, where it has two very positive ratings, both from Amazon verified purchasers. So okay. It still is a system where you have to go back to the store. Or maybe even the distributor talks to the store who talks to the customer, but you don't have a direct connection to your customer.
No, but I mean, like I said, you know, it's a lot on experience as well. You know, I mean, a lot of partners that we work with, they've been in the business for, you know, for 10, 20, 30 years. So they know, you know, what sells and what doesn't sell. And if you show it to your core group of partners, I mean, they know what's happening, you know, around the world. With their own experience, you know, you can make good judgments call. So it's mostly the minor little things that, you know, will decide, like, you know, putting it, you know, on the dial, not on the dial, those kind of issues is what we're facing. But it's not like when we introduce something that the product is just absolutely not working.
By the way, speaking of Amazon, I do see a TW Steel store, essentially. The seller is listed as TW Steel for the watch that I saw earlier. And I clicked it and I see a bunch of watches. That's not you, though.
No.
That's Amazon essentially lumping all your watches together and saying it's sold by TW Steel. And from my experience buying other products from Amazon, some of these could be real, some of them could be fake, right?
Everything's possible.
Does that piss you off that Amazon is doing that?
Well, I mean, I need to look at the example. I mean, I know that, listen, I mean, the thing is that, you know, we have to be realistic as well. And Amazon is a business, yeah? And Amazon's interest is making money for Amazon, yeah? And, you know, if they, I mean, I don't think they want to, they want to hurt the brand on purpose, but, you know, certain things mean, you know, they have to run their business the way they want to run it. And
but look at this, though. I'm looking now at Canteen Black Leather Dial Watch, and the review says, the top review says this: poor construction, all bold capital letters. The watch looks good and fits very nice, except for the fact that it fell apart after 3 months. The hands became loose and move around freely inside the case. Not a quality watch by any means. I want to return it, but I cannot because it is more than 30 days. And then the person goes on to talk about how he feels you got ripped off. But it's, in my sense, in my experience, having researched your watch, that's probably not your watch, right?
No problem. I mean, that could be. I mean, listen, we sell a lot of watches. So I'm not going to say that, you know, we never have any issues with warranty. I mean, if you sell the amount of watches that we do, I mean, you also have, you know, overall the percentage is very low, below standards, because, you know, we, you know, our product is, you know, of the best quality available, but, you know, it's certain things happen and, yeah, there's nothing you can do about it. Yeah. I mean, we receive wonderful emails here at, you know, at the info at TDB Steel where everything is collected. But, you know, you all also have very negative stories. Yeah. I mean, it's something that we have to deal with. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, we can't make everybody happy. If somebody buys a watch and it breaks down after 30 days or 60 days, I mean, you know, I would be pissed off as well. But, you know, we really want to try to help them out as best as possible to, you know, fix the problem for them, to do anything possible to get them excited again. But, you know, sometimes, you know, it happens that, you know, we just, you know, you lost the trust of a person, which is understandable. But yeah, that happens. And, you know, like I said, you know, we're very fortunate that in general, the percentage of returns is very, very low. So, you know, that pretty much everybody that buys a TDB is a very satisfied customer.
At the top of the interview, I introduce you as an entrepreneur with very little formal business education.
Yes.
The only reason I picked it is, I picked up on that, is because you happened to mention that to April. And I thought, that's a strange thing for an entrepreneur to notice. What does that ever affect you in business, that you don't have formal business? No.
No.
What made you say that, that one of your challenges is that you didn't have formal business education?
Did I put that as a challenge?
Yeah, she said, yeah, I guess so.
Well,
never had formal business education, but sold from a young age. Do you ever feel like, hey, I need to understand how an income statement works, how a balance sheet balances, what the cash flow is?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, my thing was, I'm very good with numbers.
You are.
So that was my thing from very early on.
Who does the books? Who did the books when it was just you and your dad getting started?
I did it myself. But, of course, you know, we had an external accountant, bookkeeper, that would make the year accounts. I mean, I can read them. I know how it works, but I mean, you know, that's not my my specialty. You know, doing everything when I started with TDB Steel, I used to do everything in Excel, stock reports, sales reports, everything.
And you manage it all yourself?
Yes.
How much of your money did you invest in the business?
Well, you know, we never discuss any financial.
That can't
financial.
Be a secret. We're just talking about a few thousand dollars over half a decade ago.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, but you know, I mean, the first order of you know, we did. You know, I can tell you, we did a first order of 1,200 pieces divided over four models, so 300 pieces of each. Besides the stock, I invested maybe. Maybe 10,000, something like that.
10,000 or so. And then the stock your dad invested, that was his?
No. I invested in the stock as well. Only, you know.
So it was 10,000 plus the cost of manufacturing those watches.
Plus the cost of the stock, yeah.
I see. How long did it take you to turn a profit?
A day.
A day?
So from day one, yeah. No,
because?
Because? It was from day one, we were profitable, yeah.
I see, because essentially every watch that you sold was sold at a profit, and you don't take the expense of the watches that are manufactured until they sell.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, I think it was something between $5,000 and $10,000 bucks that I invested in the beginning, for like, brochures from promotional things. And you
how
know,
long
some,
did it
some
take you to earn your first million in sales?
That's a good question. 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, that went quite quickly, yeah.
Because of the distributor.
I had the distributor in Holland, but when I saw that was successful, I started to go internationally, of course, and started to, reach out to other distributors and, I started to travel, visited some trade shows. So I started to expand quite rapidly after that initial success.
Did you celebrate it?
With my first million?
Yeah, the big first big milestone. No.
No.
What did you celebrate? What's a milestone that made you say, let's stop and take a moment to have some champagne or something?
When I sold in my second year, in that year, I sold 100,000 watches. Well, it was more overall. In that particular year, in that year alone, I sold 100,000 watches. I sold more, but by the time I reached 100,000, that was a reason for a small celebration.
And how did you celebrate?
Not extremely big, you just had a nice cake and, just realized what we had accomplished. But I mean, for me, it was great, but, I was looking for more. I was focusing to do more things. And, the big celebration was when we existed 5 years. That was the really first big celebration.
Why was that a big celebration?
I don't know. I mean, it was just, the company was doing extremely well. We grew very quickly, and it was just a nice way to reward ourselves for the hard work that was done.
So did you have any big challenges? We talked about the challenge of finding a partner, the right partner, and that's tough, but all right. We talked about the kind of challenge lack of formal education, but frankly, you could run your business from Excel from the beginning, and then you had a team of people who helped you later on. Was there any big challenge along the way, or is this just an easy ride into success?
Nah, I mean, I think, running a business, it's every day it's a challenge.
So what's the biggest challenge? Because it seems to me like this was easy.
I mean, in the beginning it was, when a product is hot, of course, it's easy because it sells, but, making sure that, from a logistics point of view that it's right, and then making the right decisions of hiring the right people, moving to, a new office and, getting all that hassle sorted. Making sure that everybody, is motivated in the team, that the distributors, they get what they need, managing them the right way. Because, it's great to sell, let's say, 100 pieces to a client. But if you know that you could also, by doing it better, sell 120 or 130, that's a challenge. So every day is a challenge. How can you increase the business? And I think that's being an entrepreneur. It's never like, quite great, business is going well. But you want to make sure that the business keeps on going well, because if you, sit back and think, oh, this is going perfect, trust me, there will come a point that it will go backwards.
Did you ever go backwards?
No.
No. What do you do to keep the team moving forward? Is it constant quotas or sales goals so that you know if you did 100 month, you're going to do 150 this month?
Yeah, I mean, sales goals, and it's, the development of the company. We started... Because I had to stop with the record company when TDB Steel was just expanding so quickly. I relaunched an entertainment company 2.5 years ago with one of my best friends, which is a talent agency for DJs and producers, where we do a lot of events. We started off very small with a couple DJs, and we now represent about 30 or 35 DJs, and we do about 200 events a year. We have our own record label again. We have our own... events department, publishing, we do everything in-house. I started a new watch brand again last year, you know, besides next to TDB Steel. And we're about to launch a new jewelry brand. So
and both those businesses are without your dad, just you.
No. I mean, the entertainment company, my dad has nothing to do with that. The other watch brand, my dad designs for that. And the jewelry, that's also something that my dad has no involvement in now.
I see. What's your revenue now?
And we unfortunately don't discuss any figures. But
are you over 25 million at this point?
Yes.
You are?
Yes.
All right, let me do a quick plug here for Mixergy Premium because I think it connects to my final question for you. Mixergy Premium, of course, as you know hopefully by now, is, and I'm saying to you, Jordy, but mostly also to the audience, if you like this interview, we have over 800 interviews with proven entrepreneurs available in the vault of Mixergy. Entrepreneurs who talk about how they built their businesses, the big challenges along the way, many of them talking about their failures and how they overcame them. And the reason that everything that we do, including the courses that are also available at Premium, everything that we do is story-based, is because one of the things that I found is that when you tell someone what to do, it just bounces right off of them, especially we entrepreneurs. We don't listen when we're told. But if you share a story, the story is relatable, the story is memorable, and it just implants itself in the listener's mind, in your mind, if you're a Mixergy Premium subscriber. All these stories that we've collected here on Mixergy will be implanted in your head, and when you need them, those experiences that other people had to suffer to earn will be there and available for you to use to guide you as you build your business. I always talk about how one of the reasons why when I wanted to sell to a big client in the beginning of my career, why I knew that I could just barge into their office unannounced, why I could just do something dramatic like bring them a big check and say, I want to partner with you and I'm willing to pay for it and all that, is because the story of Ted Turner going into those cable companies' offices unannounced and really doing things like dancing up on their desks or kissing their feet, those stories were implanted in my head. And when it was time for me to figure out how to sell, they just came out and I said, you can do something dramatic like just pop into someone's office. So that's the idea behind storytelling. Everything that we do here is guided around storytelling. If you like this format, if you agree with it, go to MixergyPremium.com. Right now, sign up for Premium because you're going to hear stories of proven entrepreneurs who tell you what they've learned. If you don't agree with it, perfectly fine. You don't have to sign up. But I think you're wrong. Go to MixergyPremium.com. Either way, go sign up, I think, and I think you'll see how effective these stories are. The quality of the entrepreneurs that we get is, it's hard to get, but it's important to bring to you. I don't want you to get the guy who says, lucky me, I just earned $1,000. Lucky me, I just started a business. Yeah, anyone could start a business. I want you to learn from the best of the best. So go to MixergyPremium.com right now. Sign up. And if I'm wrong, if you disagree with me, I'll give you your money back. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. All right. Final question for you is this.
Yes.
April, Jordy asked you what books you recommend. And here's what I'm seeing. Bios. Steve Jobs biography, Richard Branson biography, and you said biographies in general. Why biographies of entrepreneurs?
I don't know. I mean, it's just, you know, that's real life for me. You know, that's what, you know, real situations. I mean, you know, I read a lot of business books about, you know, and it's theories, you know, and I think it relates more to people, and people need to get, I mean, you know, an entrepreneur, you have it in you or you don't have it in you. And, you know, but I think, you know, by reading something like, you know, a Richard Branson, like, you know, a Steve Jobs, I mean, these are people that, you know, it explains their life story and people can really relate to that. You know, I mean, if you read business theory, you know, and you read certain cases, it's just more case by case. And they can use that when they have an issue like that. I mean, if you start a company and, okay, listen, I need to do a huge logistics expansion or something like that, and you read a book about a logistics, I mean, that's something that you can particularly then use in practice. But if you're in school and you're young and you don't know what you want to do and, you know, there's so many opportunities out there in the world and you read a book like, you know, a Steve Jobs or like a Richard Branson and it shows you, you know, what these people have done, you know, to get where they are today and following their dreams and just making things happen, you know, I think it relates more to people. And I find it, you know, I find it just, you know, fascinating to read those kind of things because, yeah, I mean, it for me, there's more emotion in it. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, with business, you know, it requires a lot of emotion, passion to do something, you know, to work that many hours. I mean, you know, not to, you know, I mean, if I relate it to myself, the amount of things that I have to give up to get where I am today, you know, I mean, it's a lot, you know. I mean, I travel very extensive, you know. I mean, I miss pretty much everybody's birthdays, you know. I miss a lot of things, you know, weddings. And, you know, it's great. Yeah, I mean, on Skype sometimes too, hey, you know, look, you know, we're at the party. And but, you know, you're still not there. And, you know, when you hang up, you know, you are by yourself in a hotel room again. You know, you're, you know, and it's, you have to be entertaining every single night when you're with clients and when you're with people, because that's what they expect from you. They expect you to motivate them and to tell them what's happening around the world. But, I mean, you know, that's, you know, you have to push yourself do that, and it's the passion and the motivation and the drive that keeps you going. And so, you know, it is hard. You know, being an entrepreneur is not easy. You know, you have, you know, in the end, your responsibility. You have no one to you know, to go back to and say, okay, can you please deal with my stuff? You know, I mean, it's in the end you, and everybody comes in the end when there's a problem that they can't handle. They come to you, and it's up to you to solve it. So, I mean, it's a big responsibility, but, you know, that's also the beauty about it.
You said that one of the reasons why you read biographies of entrepreneurs is that they inspire you and they make you feel like, yes, that person could be me. Who's the one entrepreneur who inspired you the most growing up that made you say, yes, that's a path that is available to me?
Well, I mean, when I grew up, it was my dad, for sure, because, you know, he inspired me the most. I mean, you know, when you're at that age, you're not really thinking about, you know, business biographies and, you know, those kind of books. But I think, yeah, I mean, you know, after that, I think the two people, you know, definitely Richard Branson and Steve Jobs. I mean, those are people that I think I have so much respect for, you know, for what they accomplished. And, you know, of course, you know, what happened to Steve Jobs, you know, was horrible, because, you know, I think the world could have learned so much from him and, you know, with his development and everything that he does. So I think the world really lost a very, very special person, because he, you know, he changed the world. And I think, you know, that, you know, he gets, you know, so much respect from me for what he did, you know, created something that, you know, was so revolutionary that, you know, I mean, yeah, it was, you know, and it sometimes didn't make sense. You know, if you look at, you know, for example, an iPad, if you would do a market research, people would have said, well, I got a phone, I got a laptop, why would I need something in the middle? And, you know, when it's brought out, it's not something that you need, it's something that you want to have. And I think that's just, you know, extremely clever.
Well, you built something extremely clever and inspiring yourself, and I hope that someone out there who just heard this interview will be as inspired by your story as you were by Steve Jobs and Richard Branson and all those other entrepreneurs who you read about. And my hope is that they will find a way to say thank you to you. If they want to connect with you and say thank you directly, what's a good way for them to do it?
Just write an email to info@twsteel.com, and I will definitely be more than happy to answer any questions that they have.
All right. Well, thank you for doing this interview. Thank you all for being a part of it. Remember, if you got anything out of this interview, any other interview, any freaking blog post even online, we are not just sitting in the audience of life. We are participants. So if you got any value out of anything, find a way to say thank you. Find a way to connect and not just sit back and take it in. Connect, interact, build. And then hopefully when you do all that, you'll come back here and do your own interview. Jordy, thank you so much for doing this interview. Everyone out there, thank you. Bye.